Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I'd like to introduce our guest co-host today, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Dr. Fricke is a top medical student from the University of Wisconsin and joined our UNC Family Medicine program 2 years ago. Welcome, Dr. Fricke.
Thank you very much.
And I also want to personally say that I have missed being on Your Health and being on the show since becoming chair of UNC Family Medicine, but I'm delighted to be with you today. Very thrilled to be with Dr. Fricke, and also very much looking forward to a conversation we will have with our guest today, Dr. Denise Rogers. Dr. Rogers is Vice Chancellor for Interprofessional Programs at Rutgers Biomedical and Health Sciences, and we're going to talk about how the social determinants of health and implicit bias can lead to health disparities, differences in health outcomes related to wealth or related to race and ethnicity and other factors that can be a part and actually influence the health outcomes for a person's health. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk today about counting calories and weight loss, about cleaning products and lung function, about the importance of conversation with our children and brain development, and also about drinking hot tea and esophageal cancer. So let's get started. Jonathan, what do we have first?
Well, I want to start talking about food. And this study out of the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, says counting calories is not the key to weight loss.
Well, this is tricky because we've learned a million different times throughout our life, don't eat any carbs or just eat 1,500 calories a day, or no, cut it to 1,200 calories a day, or is it 2,000? All these different messages that we've heard over time about the best weight loss strategies. Tell me what they did.
Well, this study is one where they took about 600 people, and they had them analyzed according to their genotypes to look at, can we predict which diet they're going to respond better to?
So they actually took their DNA samples to look at that level.
Exactly, trying to have this personalized medicine, the future of medicine. And then also had people they compared, what if we put them on a calorie-restricted diet versus a diet that's going to be rich in fruits and vegetables, just a general healthy diet.
So they called one group the healthy low-carb group and another the healthy low-fat group. And they had dietitians, and they were trained in how to eat and potentially how to cook. And what's the bottom line? Which diet's the best?
Well, this is good news, and I'm happy to be able to tell all my patients this, that what I would call the common sense eat your veggies group actually wins. They noticed there was significant variability in each group, but I think that it's always easier when our instructions for patients can be simple. The way that the author Michael Pollan has said it, eat not too much, mostly plants. And I think that this study supports that.
Yeah, the people who cut back on added sugar, refined grains, and highly processed foods and concentrated on eating plenty of vegetables and whole foods did the best, losing the most weight over the course of a year. So that is a lot more simple and perhaps easier advice and easier to follow in terms of overall lifestyle change. It's also interesting that no matter what your DNA or what your genome looked like, you lost more weight with that advice than any of these sort of tailored things or specific to your genetic makeup. Well, let's go to the next one. This is about cleaning products. My parents have worried that chemicals in their workplace that sometimes they've been exposed to over the years might impact their breathing. And I've heard lots of patients feel this way about their workplace. But this was a study of 6,000 people in Norway looking at that very question.
So this comes from the Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. And they looked at those 6,000 people for more than 20 years. And they looked to see if people who were exposed to cleaning chemicals in their houses had higher amounts of respiratory illnesses than those who weren't. And they found that they noticed a difference between women who used these cleaning products in their houses and those who didn't. But they didn't notice a difference in men who cleaned and those who didn't.
Well, they thought maybe because they mostly used people who were cleaners for a living, and there were fewer men working as cleaners compared with women. But also, there's this potential that women are more susceptible to the chemicals' effects. The bottom line in terms of take-home is, you know, to follow some basic common sense things if you need to use cleaners, or certainly if you need to use that a lot in your workplace, to make sure you open some windows or have well-ventilated space. I know some people who clean for a living, some of my patients will wear a mask. I don't know if that's proven to help, but it makes sense that it might.
And I think it underscores for me that cleaning is important, but also that a lot of these products that we use for cleaning can have effects that we might not be completely aware of still.
That's right. More study. Okay. The brain-changing power of conversation. This is a study and report from Psychological Sciences showing how conversation, the interplay between a parent and a child, ignites the language centers in the brain. So, you know, this is partly research done at Harvard and MIT, really looking to examine more related to the dramatic gap in the number of words heard by high-income children compared with low-income children. We're talking about health disparities today, so this is something that comes into play for sure in our future conversation.
Now, this is something that I get passionate about because this is an area that I've done research in before, and I just love, it's my favorite part of the visits with families when we get to talk about reading books with kids, because who doesn't love it? And it's good for your kids. I tell my families that this is the single most important thing that you can do in order to help your kid get ready for grade school, is to be reading together as a family. We see that it's not just the quantity of words, but it's the quality. And now we have further research confirming what we've known before. This is specifically looking at changes in the brain, measuring those, getting better nuances to what we've known for a while.
So the takeaway there is to read with your children, talk to your children, interact with them. That improves brain development. And ideally, that would be done in your native language or in your most passionate conversations with your children. My kids exactly. are a little bit older, 12 and 10, but those conversations are just rich and important still. The last one we're going to talk about drinking hot tea. Now, this one it struck my attention when I was looking at this, Jonathan, because drinking hot tea is something I've been doing more of lately. I've been on this whole life challenge looking at sleep and nutrition and all these different parts. And as part of that, I have made an effort, instead of having a glass of wine with dinner or very much limiting my alcohol intake so that I'm not drinking but maybe once a week a glass of wine, to switch to tea. And hot tea, herbal tea, has felt like a nice way to treat myself in the evenings. It's special. And I don't have the unnecessary calories or those other things that come with a glass of wine. But this says, oh, wait, should I pay attention to this?
Now, every time that I see a study that says anything about tea or coffee or alcohol, I always have a high level of suspicion before reading the study. Because studies tell you coffee's good, coffee's bad, tea is good, tea is bad. This seems to support things that we've known for a while. This is from the Annals of Internal Medicine. This is 450,000 people that they followed long-term, and they found that the risk of esophageal cancer is higher in tea drinkers, particularly in those who also drank alcohol regularly and smoked regularly.
So I'm not going to get esophageal cancer.
As long as you're not drinking or smoking.
Okay. But it's true. These sorts of things come out and it seems like, oh, does that mean hot tea is bad? And no, they're just saying what they found is that hot tea at high temperatures for people who also drink alcohol and smoke cigarettes does provide an increased risk for esophageal cancer. So it's complicated in the nuance. But the people who had all three of those habits, consumed alcohol excessively, smoked, and drank high-temperature tea, had 5 times greater risk of esophageal cancer. If we find a patient who's doing all three of those things, we ought to make sure that they stop.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that wraps up the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with our guest, our fantastic expert guest, Dr. Denise Rogers. She's Vice Chancellor for Interprofessional Programs at Rutgers. We're going to talk about how the social determinants of health and implicit bias lead to health disparities and what we can do about it. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Jonathan Fricke.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our guest co-host, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Denise Rogers, Vice Chancellor for Interprofessional Programs at Rutgers Biomedical and Health Sciences, about how social determinants of health and implicit bias can lead to health disparities. We're so glad to have you with us today, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to start off, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what interests led you to the work that you do today?
Well, basically, when I went to medical school, it was pretty clear to me that I wanted to work with underserved populations. I originally thought that I wanted to work in the rural South, and then I did a rotation in New York City and ended up doing my residency at Montefiore in the Bronx and said, I think I'm a big city person.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful program.
It was a terrific, and still is, terrific mm-hmm. program. And from that program, it became clear that I wanted to devote my career to working with urban underserved populations. And as I went through my career, primarily working in community clinics and federally qualified health centers, it became clear that a lot of the issues that my patients were grappling with were not the traditional issues that I, as a family physician, was going to be able to address just in the context of the office.
And so give us a sense of what it means, what we're talking about, these social determinants of health. This is language that we use a lot in family medicine and in our circles, but it strikes me that that might not be as obvious to most people. What are we talking about with the social determinants of health?
So the World Health Organization talks about social determinants as being the circumstances in which you are born, grow up, work, live, play, and age, and the foundations that are available to you to deal with your health issues. These social determinants are impacted by economics, by politics, by policies, that sort of thing.
Give us a sense from a patient level of perhaps a patient that you've seen that had a health problem that you really had to factor in more than this person's sore throat or their abdominal pain, but you really had to think of it in the context of the social determinants of health.
Well, certainly one of the social determinants that we still have to grapple with, less than we used to, but we still have to grapple with, is just insurance. So insurance is a social determinant of health, and the degree to which certain patients get access to certain kinds of services because they have insurance or not is a major consideration for us. Probably a more straightforward social determinant as well is when we care for people who are homeless. And you give someone who's homeless medications and say, by the way, you have to keep this refrigerated. And, oh, by the way, you have to take this medication 3 times a day. And these are the specific hours when you need to take them. And the person may not have a watch. The person definitely doesn't have a refrigerator. And so we have to then get creative and think about how do we make appropriate adjustments so that this person can get needed treatment, but in the context of their much more complicated lives than many of the other patients that we see.
How much of a mismatch is there between what physicians generally say or advise to patients and what then turns out to be this reality of those other determinants of their health that may be barriers to actually following through with physician advice?
I like the way you frame that question in terms of the mismatch. So one of my major goals in life is to significantly reduce that mismatch by helping all physicians understand that they need to ask about social determinants. Mm. It isn't sufficient to just ask patients, how are you feeling today, and how's your diabetes, et cetera. We need to have an understanding, and particularly as family physicians, but all primary care physicians, we need to have an understanding of the context of people's lives. Where do you live? Do you have enough food to eat? Do you have housing insecurity? If we don't ask about those things, we do exactly what you just described, which is there's a huge mismatch in the advice we give patients and the reality of what they're able to do based on some challenges they may be facing in their lives.
So we're talking about a mismatch between what we offer as clinicians and what our patients need. Do you also see mismatches in terms of what patients are receiving care, what certain patient groups are being left out of this, and how does that factor into this whole conversation?
So we still have problems in the United States with people being uninsured. We also have problems in the United States of people being underinsured. And so there's a segment of people who just aren't able to get the care that they need. We have significant problems with people having access to coverage for their medications. And this problem goes throughout the age range, from very young children, adults, and even seniors. I think that if we don't take a step back and really purposefully look at the context of our patients' lives, we can often fall into this trap of then being frustrated by our patients not doing the things we tell them to do. Sometimes we have poor diabetic patients who continue to have their blood sugars be very high, and we blame them for this. Sometimes we say, you don't care enough to take care of your diabetes properly. But when we take a step back and we say, do you have access to the fruits and vegetables and high-quality food that we want you to eat, we then learn that many of our patients, far more of our patients actually than we understand, are food insecure. We then begin to understand, well, what are some of the other economic challenges you face? We have patients who, what we call couch surf, if you will. So they're not homeless in the street, but they're homeless in the sense that they go from relative to friend to neighbor to relative to friend to neighbor because they don't have a permanent place to live. Imagine how hard it is to organize your food and your medications and your lifestyle, if you will, if that's your life circumstance.
Or patients who get on a list of they frequently no-show. They make an appointment and don't show up. And then they get on a list that makes it harder for them to get an appointment because this is a person who might take a spot and not show up. Yeah. And we're placing more barriers. You know, when you find out one fact, they don't have a car, they're relying on someone for a ride, and perhaps what they really need is help with transportation or just go to a clinic that's on the bus route or, you know, those sorts of basic creative things to help that person be more than just a no-show to the clinic.
That's exactly right.
This is so complicated. Now, help us understand more about how these social determinants of health are related to health disparities. And I think we probably ought to define what health disparities are.
Well, in this country, we describe health disparities as being outcomes that are worse than the outcomes that you would expect from an affluent white population. Mm-hmm. I think increasingly we ought to begin to look at outcomes that vary from the very best outcomes that happen in the world. So in the United States, we don't have anything close to the best health outcomes for our population as a whole, even though we spend more money than any other country in the world. But for the sake of this conversation, we're talking about the difference between white affluent patient outcomes and the outcomes of others. We know, for example, that if you are poor in America, you are more likely to be in poor health in America, regardless of your race or ethnicity. We know, for example, that those who were born in 1950, who are in the bottom 10% of income, live 14 years less than those born in 1950 who were in the top 10% of income.
14 years.
14 years.
When you hear somebody say our nation overall has a broken healthcare system, we should work on improving healthcare for all, what I hear you saying is that there are groups that need to be targeted specifically. How do you strike that balance between improving healthcare for all and narrowing that gap between the best off and the worst off?
Well, I think let's talk about two different things. I am a huge proponent of healthcare access for all. I believe that we need a single payer system in this country so that we completely eliminate the issue of inadequate insurance, right? But that only gets us so far. It doesn't address the issue of transportation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't address the issue of adequate housing, access to nutritious food. If you look at the difference between what much of the developed world, Western Europe, for example, spends on health compared to the United States, they spend significantly less. But they spend more on social services. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to do in this country as well, is we need a more comprehensive look at those things that are required to ensure that everyone has better health outcomes.
Well, that is a place for us to take a quick bookmark on the conversation. We do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Dr. Denise Rogers. She is Vice Chancellor for Interprofessional Programs at Rutgers Biomedical and Health Sciences, and we're talking about how social determinants of health can lead to health disparities. And we'll be back with more on this conversation on Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our guest co-host, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. We've been talking with Dr. Denise Rogers, our guest and Huntley lecturer. She is Vice Chancellor for Interprofessional Programs at Rutgers, and we're talking about social determinants of health and implicit bias, how that can lead to health disparities. And before the break, we talked with Dr. Rogers, who outlined for us what are the social determinants of health. We're talking about things like food security, safe housing, transportation, elements outside of just what you would think of in traditional medical visit that impact a person's health. We talked a little bit about how that leads to health disparities and some differences, but I'm struck, Dr. Rogers, just thinking about the number of physicians who wouldn't describe themselves or would think that they're giving the same level of care to everyone and would think, well, in my practice, I treat everyone the same, and therefore people will have the same level of care. And yet, when we look at the data, it says that that's not necessarily the case. There are these major differences, even from physicians who wouldn't think they're racist or wouldn't think they're judging or wouldn't think they're doing it. It's still there. Talk to us a little bit about what we know about that and then maybe what leads to that.
So there are two phenomena that occur in this country around this. One is health care disparities, and mm-hmm. the other is health disparities. Mm-hmm. The literature tells us that we in the health care system often do treat patients differently by race, ethnicity. There was a powerful study done many years ago by a guy named Shulman, who took essentially the same patients, gave them the same lab results and EKG results, and gave them to a group of physicians and only varied the race of the patients. And in this instance, in his study, he found that African American patients were less likely to get a cardiac workup when compared to their white counterparts. Studies like this have been replicated over and over again. There was a report by the Institute of Medicine called Unequal Treatment from 2003 that documents extensively the ways in which we in the healthcare system treat patients differently based on race, even when you control for insurance status and socioeconomic status.
And this is touching on this concept of implicit bias that we put in our title, but we haven't touched on yet, where a person can say, no, 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 I'm not racist. There's no way I'm racist. And then, because, you know, racist has its own definition. But then in these implicit bias tests, we have across gender, across race, these certain elements that bias our affinity or our connection of two words that you wouldn't think, I mean, you just wouldn't predict about oneself than when you get and do these kinds of testing. Unpack that a little bit for listeners, what we're talking about with implicit bias.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we all grow up in this society with certain biases that just come from growing up in this culture. So it's changing a little bit, but in healthcare, we still think doctors men, nurses women.
Mm-hmm.
We're making significant progress with that, but when I talk to the medical students that I work with, many of the women still say when they walk in the room, a lot of the patients will think they're the nurse.
Oh, yeah.
That's implicit bias. It's just this assumption about who a person is based on that very first look, that first impression. In the Shulman study, one of the things that they discovered was that the physicians answering that question thought the black patients were more likely to have Medicaid. Implicit bias. I mean, it's who we associate with being poor versus not. And in general, implicit bias, as described, is just that. It is not something we consciously do. It's just assumptions that we make from our unconscious minds that then translate into our behaviors.
I was also struck in this particular research talk that I went to that in the workplace, women still have those same biases about women. And they found certain minority groups had those same implicit biases too, which also was confusing to me. Then, okay, well, if we all have these things built in, how do we change it?
The key is to begin to recognize that we have these biases. I mean, I think that's the beauty of the implicit bias test that so many people can go online and now take for themselves. Because if we recognize our biases, then we are more likely to consciously work to overcome them.
You're talking on the personal level about the implicit bias testing. It also sounds like there are some initiatives on a larger level. In fact, right here in our own state with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Can you tell us a little bit more about those initiatives and what those are working to change?
So the initiatives that you're asking about are part of the Culture of Health initiative funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation several years ago. This is a wonderful initiative that really has come to change the way in which communities think about how do we do better at improving the health outcomes of people who live in our area. And that specifically is focusing on social determinants of health. So here in North Carolina, you have two counties that won awards actually from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for their work, Buncombe County and Durham County. And you have a third county, Granville County, that has also been recognized for their work in improving health outcomes. And this is really what it's going to take to make a difference, for people in communities to come together and say, we are going to take some responsibility on the social services side to say, health improvement isn't just the problem of hospitals and doctors' offices, but it is a community-wide effort.
One of the things that's local in North Carolina is that the health of rural North Carolinians is declining over time. And that's no surprise. That's true in other states and other areas of our nation and across the world. But it's still, when it's home and you see these numbers, we've been working at some of our issues for rural North Carolina for years and years, so many different approaches. And yet, our access to care is getting worse and our actual health outcomes are getting worse over time. And I wonder, you know, how that fits in with your work. And this really does, it inspires me that those three counties have really made a difference in partnering with Robert Wood Johnson. But as we think about this as a state, or as our listeners are thinking, how can I be a part of making a difference in these areas? where's really the best place for us to put our energy to making a difference?
Well, certainly on the social determinant side, we need to look at things like the quality of education in rural areas. We need to look at things like, as you described, access to health care. We need to look at access to jobs. What we know is in rural parts of the country, it is important to just have a place for people to be able to go. And we need to have a better understanding of why those places are going away. And part of why those places are going away has to do with the economics of health care and also the economics of the areas.
It's complicated.
It's very complicated. It's very complicated. But we know that if we don't address social determinants of health in rural areas, just putting that one clinic there is not going to be sufficient to help improve the overall outcomes.
Oh, that's a good word. Do you have any other sort of summary statements or a call to action for our listeners of how people who are perhaps not engaged in this conversation to date or who want to be thoughtful and helpful in their communities, how could people learn more or get activated to begin to contribute to the social determinants of health?
Well, one of the things I certainly urge people to do in communities is to go look at the Robert Wood Johnson Culture of Health website to see what people in other communities are doing, learn from them, take some of those ideas and bring them into your own communities. I think we also have to, each of us in our own lives, strive to do the best that we can for our own health so that we make sure that we exercise and eat properly and pay attention to our own spiritual health as well.
I would imagine, too, for a patient, it may be uncomfortable sometimes to raise these types of issues if either you don't understand what the doctor's saying or if you aren't able to make it to the clinic or if there are other barriers about, you know, not having refrigeration, to be able to open up that dialogue and invite those conversations with your family members or with your physician or with your community members to be sure that those basic needs are being met, but also that there's open communication so that people can help work through those challenges together.
That's exactly right.
Well, we are just delighted to have you with us today. And this is such a complicated conversation that we've really just scratched the surface on, but a fantastic beginning to the conversation. We're delighted to have you here in town with us in North Carolina. And we look forward to learning more from you and hopefully having you back again in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Denise Rogers, Vice Chancellor for Interprofessional Programs at Rutgers Biomedical and Health Sciences, about the social determinants of health, implicit bias, and how that leads to health disparities, but with a lot of hope for investment in our communities for the future. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. John, what a great conversation that was with Dr. Rogers. I was sad that it had to end because we were really barely scratching the surface of some of these issues and some of the ways we can move forward.
You know, there's so much to talk about, and I think as a nation, so much to be talking about this time, that it's something that we carry forward in conversations that we have around our dinner tables as well.
Agree. And I want to be sure that we put up a link to some of that implicit bias testing. Have you taken it?
I have.
There are places you can go online. We'll put a link on our website. Our fantastic health sciences librarians will do this for us, where you can go on and take the test for yourself to see what sort of implicit bias you might have in your own thinking, which is usually very surprising. But it starts, as Dr. Rogers said, with understanding some of those things that are ingrained in us. Well, we're going to move on to the House Call segment of our show today, and we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns. If you have a question you'd like for us to address on a show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. So John and I will have our executive producer, Laura Lacey, read us our very first House Call question.
I just started seeing a new specialist for a thyroid imbalance, and as usual, I had to fill out a ton of paperwork about my health data, privacy, etc. Can you give me an overview in layman's terms of what exactly I signed and all that documentation?
Well, it's a little hard for us to see and know exactly what you signed, but a lot of that is collecting health information that will guide the physician or clinician in taking good care of you. Some of that has to do with access to your medical data from other places to try to get some health history from your medical record and find out from you who we're allowed to share that with and some of that kinds of information. Sometimes it has information on those intake exams about, you know, your faith background or other elements that may be important to your health. And some of it's just more health history. What am I missing, Jonathan?
Yeah, Christy, I find that this is one of the most important and helpful things to have a good new patient visit. When a patient has taken the time to request information from their former providers before coming to see me, I can review this. And instead of taking the visit time to review their entire history in person, I can have looked through their records briefly and just have some brief targeted questions and talk about what's bothering them that day.
I'd also say if the forms you're signing are in, like, legal terms or they're in words that seem confusing, you should ask what they're about. Don't sign it. Ask somebody to explain it to you. And if that person can't explain it to you, then just take it to the next person. But you have a right to understand what you're signing. So good job asking the question. All right, what do we have next?
Our next listener says, I'm a 25-year-old woman and my brother was diagnosed with celiac disease last year. I'm prone to gastrointestinal issues myself. Should I go get checked for celiac? If I did have it, how would I have to change my lifestyle?
Another great question. For our listeners, celiac disease is an autoimmune disorder. It's usually a GI or a small intestine kind of a problem, and usually people have some genetic predisposition to have it. So it makes sense that you're asking this question since your brother had the diagnosis, because that does put you at higher risk that you could have this problem as well. But usually the symptoms are related to diarrhea or abdominal pain or feeling gas or uncomfortable GI symptoms. So what do you think, John? Should she get tested?
I agree that this is an important thing to get tested. For people who are having symptoms, which it sounds like you're having symptoms, there's pretty widespread agreement that because this is a genetic condition, it's worthwhile to test any first-degree relatives that are having other GI symptoms, things like abdominal bloating, diarrhea, etc.
A lot of times in children, this could present as something where the baby's not growing as well or something like that. But at your age, usually the symptoms are pretty vague. So it's reasonable to get tested. And in terms of what you'd have to change, well, you'd have to decrease gluten in your diet because that's the part that the body is reacting to. So I would talk it over with your doctor before you started changing your lifestyle and see what testing would be appropriate, if any, and kind of go from there in a partnership. It's not an emergency, but it would be good to go to your primary care doctor, sit down, and really have a conversation about that. Okay, we have one more house call question.
The last one is, I'm a 72-year-old man who has cataracts. At what point do I need to consider surgery, and what would happen during that surgery?
So cataracts are a very normal problem that happens to anyone if they live long enough. And basically, the short answer to your question is, when they're bothering you, that's the time to get them taken care of. We can sometimes notice them on an exam earlier on, or you might notice small changes, but something that doesn't interfere with your life. But when it comes to the point where you're having difficulty getting around with your everyday life, that's the point where I tell you to go and talk to an ophthalmologist and try to get this taken care of. And specifically, what happens during the surgery, it's a pretty basic routine procedure, actually, and it's as far as surgeries go, it's an outpatient procedure and a relatively straightforward, quick recovery process.
We can post something also online about cataracts and about the procedure of getting those cataracts removed. But yes, it's a very straightforward procedure. Most people come out and are thankful that they had it done. So that concludes the House Calls questions today. Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. Share your questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook. Get our health app through the App Store. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. And we'd like to have a special thanks to Dr. Denise Rogers for her time with us today.
And I also want to thank you, Dr. Fricke, for being our guest co-host today. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Jonathan Fricke.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.